This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You will see in a grocery store not only very high waste, but at the same time, when you go, a lot of the items that you want to buy are completely sold out. And so it's kind of this interesting situation where both sides are falling behind, and it's because the decision-making process, which should be done by machine learning and AI, but is done by a human.
What can we do to be better citizens, better consumers, and better advocates for the planet? Fighting waste and saving forests are a good place to start. This week on Sea Change Radio, we first talked to California Assembly member Ash Khara about his new bill to save tropical forests. California may not have rainforests of its own, but Khara explains how we're all playing a role in their destruction and how we all have an obligation to help save them. Then we hear from Stefan Kalb about his company Shelf Engine, which helps grocery stores eliminate waste. We learn how stores usually handle their perishables, and how Shelf Engine intends to change all this. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Assemblymember Ash Khara. He represents District 27 in California. Ash, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Great to be back after some time.
That's right. Last time we had you on, you were a city councilman in San Jose, correct?
That's right.
So I wanted to have you on because you recently introduced a bill which caught my eye, AB 572, which is about saving tropical forests. And most people would think, well, I don't know of any tropical forests in California, but why is this something that Californians and all Americans need to be focused on?
I think everyone, no matter where they live in the world, should be concerned about tropical deforestation, but especially Americans, because being the largest consumers on the face of the earth, you know, we are contributing greatly to impacts that consumption is causing. And on top of that, as we know, as we deal with issues of climate change and global warming, we recognize that impacts on the environment that contribute to global warming don't recognize borders, whether they're state borders or national borders. If there's pollution that's occurring in other parts of the world, or in this case, deforestation that's occurring, it's affecting all of us. And as we try to become bolder as a state in trying to lead the nation on issues of climate change, we can't ignore what's happening in other parts of the world.
Why don't you walk us through the framework of AB 572? How will it help protect rainforests, ideally?
So the idea behind it is that in procurement, our state procurement policy, that as the bill is called, the California Deforestation Free Procurement Act, that as folks or companies are applying for contracts with the state, and you know, California is a very large public purchaser, one of the largest in the world, that they have to ensure that their operations and their supply chains are not contributing to tropical deforestation, and have in place what's called an NDPE, no deforestation, no peat, no exploitation policy. And right now, my understanding is that France and Norway have this policy in place. And if we do it, we would become the largest economy in the world to have a deforestation-free procurement policy, as we are the fifth largest economy in the world right now.
Can you talk about how verification would occur in a pretty deep supply chain system like wood?
Yes. And that's part of what we hope to do in the next few weeks and months as this bill goes through the legislative process is not only to define what it means to be deforestation free, which is an important part of this. The NDPE policy does help in terms of that kind of definition, but also the accountability. And I think it starts really with having standards that that we can all agree upon, because some companies are already claiming that a number of them already claim that they already have their own internal policies, but we have to have a consistent policy that can be relied upon. And then once we have that in place, we can work on the accountability standards. But there's no doubt that there are very, very large companies that have very large contracts with the state, whether it's in food and food products, furniture, as you mentioned, you know, wood, you know, so lumber and what have you, different kinds of metals. And so we want to make sure that we're not contributing to deforestation, but there's no doubt that it's not a simple kind of just check the box kind of proposition, that there's going to take, it's going to take work, and it may take even a few years to really get both the definition and accountability pieces fine-tuned. But we want to get something in place right now, so at least the policy is in place, and then as we go forward, we can see how the policy is working.
Yes, when I mentioned wood, that's really just a drop in the bucket. There are wood products, of course, but there's rubber, cattle, palm oil, lots and lots of different products that are coming from fragile ecosystems that we're trying to respect. So why don't you walk us through kind of the behind-the-scenes evolution of a bill like this? This isn't something that just kind of sprang organically from you and your staff, I'm imagining. I see that there's a lot of support from organizations like Amazon Watch and Greenpeace and Rainforest Action Network. Do those nonprofits come to you and lobby you to push this bill through, or maybe just walk us through how it works?
There's a variety of ways. Sometimes we do come up with the ideas internally. For example, I have a bill that right now we've introduced that would require voting centers on college campuses. That was an idea my chief of staff came up with and brought forward, and we're moving forward with that.
Good idea.
Yeah, it's good, right? That's not uncommon. This one is actually something that kind of has percolated over the last couple of years. When I first started here in the legislature, And I've, as you know, I've had a long time interest in environmental issues. And then I was appointed to the Water Parks and Wildlife Committee, which allowed me to further delve into the issue. Last year, with the Environmental Defense Fund, I was able to join a couple of the colleagues and go down to the Amazon forest in Brazil and really saw firsthand not only the impacts of deforestation in the case of the Amazon and in the Acre region of Brazil. It's really for cattle grazing, which is kind of strange because actually the land is not very good for cattle grazing, but it's a quick buck. And so what we learned is not only the industries that are impacting or leading to deforestation, certainly in that region, but the fact that the Amazon has a wealth of resources, and that if the indigenous tribes and the rubber tappers learn how to commodify it, that there's no need to chop down a single tree because there's so much value in what's coming out of the Amazon. And so that was a really great experience for me in terms of learning more and more about the impacts of deforestation. And you made mention of palm oil. That was another issue that was raised to me early on since I got up here. And this bill, in fact, first started as, okay, you know, how do we address the issue of palm oil? But we recognize that really it's not just about palm oil itself. It's about the fact that our deforestation is really ravaging our planet in so many different ways. And so, you know, the idea has been out there, and as we start a new legislative session, you're absolutely right. You know, people come to us, whether it's business groups, labor groups, environmental groups, you name it, healthcare groups, that they come to us and say, hey, we have an idea. And if there are ideas that resonate with me and are consistent with my values and my goals, I'll certainly take them, take them seriously, take a good look at them. And if it makes sense, we'll introduce the bill with the support of sponsors oftentimes. In this case, the two groups that the primary sponsors that came to us earlier on were Social Compassion Legislation and Friends of the Earth. And as we've introduced the bill, we also have Peace for Animals that have joined. So those are the three formal sponsors. And some of the groups you mentioned, we look very much forward to listing them as supporters of the bill as the bill goes, as well as other groups, as the bill goes through the legislative process. And so we work closely with the sponsors, and we continue to, in order to put forward the initial language. And then as it goes through committees, we work very closely with committee staff who have great expertise. You know, the committee staffs that we work with, many of them have been working on those issues for a number of years. So we really appreciate some of the civil servants that really do have great expertise.
Why boast at thyself, O evil man?
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with California Assemblymember Ash Kalra. He represents District 27. So Ash, let's dive into the politics a little bit behind this. Now, California has a distinct Democratic majority in its assembly. So I'm assuming that you will be able to get this passed, but what kind of pushback can you expect from special interest groups?
First of all, yes, we do have a super majority of Democrats, both in the Assembly and Senate, and we have a progressive governor who is interested in issues such as these, such as this one. But
friend of the show, he came on Sea Change Radio last year.
He's really. It's been a pleasure in the very short time he's been governor just to see how he's been operating and how committed he is to so many different progressive causes, and the environment certainly is one of them. But it doesn't mean this is going to be easy just because someone's a Democrat. Not all Democrats are the same. And we have Democrats in more rural communities. We have Democrats that in some cases are more closely aligned with some of the corporate interest or fossil fuel industry, what have you. And so this is by no means a guarantee that it's going to kind of glide all the way to the governor's desk. There's going to be a lot of work involved. There may be some compromises along the way, but one of the things that I do is I never compromise on the principles, of a bill or the underlying purpose of the bill. And so I'd rather have a bill not make it to the governor's desk or have a bill die along the way than to have it watered down so much that it doesn't resemble the original intent, let alone language, because I'm not interested in just waving around bills that I got signed by the governor. I really want substantive, meaningful change, and this bill right now has it. And I look forward to keeping the integrity of the bill and having it move through the legislature.
So there are no other states that currently have something like this in place, correct?
There are no other states. We would be the first in the nation. And as I mentioned, the only nation states that have this policy are Norway and France. So we'd be the third government that I'm aware of that would have a policy like this. And again, as mentioned, we would be the largest economy in the world to have a policy of this nature.
If in 2020,
we have a Democratic president. Do you see that this Assembly Bill 572 could be a template for a federal measure with similar effects?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that's not uncommon for California to lead the nation on policies, on progressive policies, certainly in regards to the environment and a number of other areas as well. So absolutely. I mean, if we can take back the White House as Democrats and we have this policy in place here, I would really look forward to having the opportunity to, you know, make the case at the federal level that that this should also be a federal policy.
Assemblymember Ash Kalra. Ash, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. I look forward to coming back again, hopefully sooner rather than later.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Stefan Kalb. He is the co-founder of Shelf Engine. Stefan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, Alex. Thanks for having me.
So what is Shelf Engine in a nutshell?
Yeah, Shelf Engine does something that's pretty unique. We guarantee sales for grocery stores. And what that actually means is that we manage orders for their highly perishables, and we reimburse them for anything that doesn't sell. So yeah, that's basically it at a high level.
And you're a technology solution mostly, right?
Yeah, you could think of us in terms of a technology and service solution. We're pretty unique in the way that we don't just necessarily sell a technology platform. We actually manage people's orders. So you can think of us as more of a service that uses artificial intelligence to be able to predict those orders.
So you've explained what it does. What's at the heart of your company's mission, though?
I think the message that I just really want people to understand is that, you know, waste is pretty high at these stores, and it really just doesn't need to be. If you do something like what we do, which is essentially replacing the human decision, and we rolled that out in every store in the United States, it makes such a massive impact. We would probably see some sort of dent in global warming because of it, right? And that's something that I wish people really understood and saw, is that the human decision here is creating an enormous amount of waste. So I think we have a ton of opportunity, and that's really exciting to me.
So let's say I'm the manager of a Whole Foods, and I've noticed that we're throwing away way too many pasta salads. How would Shelf Engine help me?
Yeah, so going into a little bit more detail, what tends to happen, especially with the Whole Foods of the world, is they will go to their vendors and they will say, hey, vendor, we would like to carry this pasta salad, but if it doesn't sell, we want you to buy it back. And that's the traditional guaranteed sale where a vendor is managing the order for Whole Foods.
Even after it expires? Like,
correct.
How does that equation work for the pasta manufacturer in this?
Right, which is a very fair question. Yes, absolutely, especially if the pasta expires, right? So what Whole Foods is saying is, we don't want to take inventory risk of this item. We want you to do it, and we're giving you essentially a platform to sell many of these. And so that's a pretty common form for a grocery store to do, is to say, hey, we will carry you, but we want you to guarantee this sale.
And the pasta salad maker in this hypothetical situation would figure that their margins are good enough so that, let's say, they only sell 2/3 of their product, it would still be profitable for them.
Correct, correct. You're absolutely leading the right direction there. So the pasta maker in this particular case has two different prices. One price, which is what you would call essentially the regular or straight sale price, and the other price, which is their guaranteed sale or their buyback price. Now, Whole Foods in this case will get many of their vendors to guarantee the sale, and so the vendor is managing the order. In the cases that they don't, they're the ones on their side. They have a buyer that's deciding every day how many pasta salads are going to come in. Now, whether it's the store that's deciding to do this or the vendor that's deciding to do this, it's mostly a human perspective with huge human judgment to decide how much they're going to order. And this is where the value of Shelf comes in, because if you're a human trying to decide this, it's an overwhelming amount of data. right? You're talking about thousands of SKUs that you're managing. Even if you're in the hundreds of SKUs of managing every day, there is an enormous amount of data there.
So many variables, right? Because
in so many variables,
usually you're looking at a pretty large sample size and there's lots of variants. You could have like some party that somebody's throwing and they all of a sudden throw off your estimates, right? That's why we so often go to the store and they're sold out of our favorite things.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, Alex. And not only are a lot of the variables in there, but there's also a ton of bias. So if I gave you some, you know, very basic numbers, which is how much pasta salad was delivered and how much was wasted every day for a month, and then I said, okay, how much pasta salad should be delivered on that Monday, you'd likely have a very hard time predicting how much pasta salad to actually order. And the reason is that you need to essentially create a probability calculation in terms of what's the actual chance that that 10th pasta salad or that 11th pasta salad is going to sell and match it up to the gross margin of that product, because that gross margin is how much risk you can take on that product. Now, a human can't really process this just by looking at the numbers, but that's generally how ordering actually works. The human looking at a clipboard with a piece of paper and trying to figure out those numbers. Hence why you will see in a grocery store not only very high waste, but at the same time, when you go, a lot of the items that you want to buy are completely sold out. And so it's kind of this interesting situation where both sides are falling behind, and it's because the decision-making process, which should be done by machine learning and AI, but is done by a human.
So sticking with this vendor, just to be clear, if the pasta salad expires, a Whole Foods doesn't actually send it back to them, I'm assuming. They just charge them for it and throw it away, or can that be salvaged?
Great question. So it is industry standard for the vendor to actually take that product back themselves. And the natural question that I think you're getting to is saying, okay, well, even if you can optimize the order and you can reduce that amount of waste, where does that actually go? Now, there are plenty of vendors that actually work directly with food banks so that pasta salad manufacturer can, you know, take that and go donate it to a food bank. Or the store will manage it on their side and it'll have a food bank or some food donation program come and pick it up. You're probably also wondering, okay, what's the percentage of that that actually gets donated? Having been in the industry for a long time and having built my own wholesale food company in the past, and having donated a significant amount of food, it's actually fairly, it's a lot of work to donate food, which is fairly striking. But there is a huge amount of opportunity out there to donate a lot more food, a significant amount of that food right now, and I can't give you specific percentages because I don't really know, is just being composted instead of being donated.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the co-founder of Shelf Engine, Stefan Kalb. So Stefan, give us kind of a snapshot of the industry on the whole. You've said that Shelf Engine's algorithms can beat what an average human brain can do in terms of calculating how much to order for a store. But how many stores are relying on software solutions versus just using their smarts, their own brain, to try to ballpark it?
Yeah, you know, Alex, your question is a great question, which is essentially how much are grocers relying on technology today to be able to automate their ordering such that they can reduce food waste? And the very simple answer at this point is the technology on the retailer's front, on the grocer's front, is absolutely advancing and making really big headway, especially when it comes to the point of sale systems. In terms of the ordering systems, it's not really coming into play in a huge way in terms of predicting how much to order yet. It's just starting to, but the majority of stores really just have systems in place to be able to manage systems and manage requirements, but they're not necessarily forecasting orders to be able to reduce waste. I mean, shelf today outperforms a human so much so that it's able to reduce the waste almost by half and at the same time increase the sales for that store. There is no system out there that I know of that has that kind of ability. And to be honest, most stores, even if they do have the systems, the buyers are still relying on spreadsheets and or pieces of paper to manage their orders.
We just did a piece recently on Trader Joe's and how popular it is, but then how much plastic it uses. And one of their kind of dirty little secrets is they package their produce in a way that you end up buying more than you can use, and that waste gets passed on to the customer. Now, recently I was in a Trader Joe's and I grumbled that they used too much plastic, and they said they're working on eliminating a lot of that plastic by the end of the year. So we often look at like a company like Safeway that has their open produce, and sure, they may not use as much plastic, but their items that don't get sold, you're telling me, often get charged back to the vendor themselves. Maybe you can contrast the traditional large grocer model like a Safeway to how a Trader Joe's works with their packaging and bundling produce.
Here is really my basic opinion as a person, rather than specifically speaking on behalf of Shelf, is that the responsibility in terms of this food waste very heavily relies on the grocer. Now, the grocer is making a lot of these decisions because they know that if they're off the mark in terms of their selection, that you as a consumer are going to be disappointed and not come back to that store. And so they're going to have gross misordering and overordering because they want you to be able to have that selection. Now, what that leads to is very, very large amounts of waste. Actually, the waste in this country is gravely understated because most of it is not actually recorded in the process of the store. Some stores will say that their waste is anywhere from 2 to 5%. And it's completely inaccurate if you actually change the denominator a bit, which is actually looking at the highly perishables. Their waste is much, much higher, likely somewhere in the 20 percentile range. And do I find that to be their responsibility? Absolutely. Can we make an impact there and be able to make some headway? Absolutely. I think me as a consumer, being able to talk to the stores and being able to say, hey, this is really important to me, is one very first important step. Does that go all the way to the place of policy? Absolutely. And I think that, especially in terms of our environment today, it's going to become a more and more impactful place to be able to have that conversation. But the responsibility absolutely lies within the grocers.
He's the co-founder of Shelf Engine, Stefan Kalb. Stefan, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Hey, Alex, thanks.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Derek Trucks Band, The Wailers, and Isaac Hayes. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.